Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning on the program, we'll be talking about money, how to take care of yours. And we have three guys here who have been with us many times before to advise you on financial planning and money management. It's a topic that we have made a regular feature of this program because we know people will always have these questions. And we'll get to questions in just a bit here. But while we're on the subject of money, we'd like to have some of yours. This is our spring pledge drive. It's the time that we ask people to support the station with their financial contribution. What that does is it makes it possible for us to do the programs that you enjoy and depend on. And the best way we have of getting the message across is simply to ask, to sit right here in front of the microphones and say, okay, think about the show and think about how important it is to you. And if it means something, well, just pay a little bit of the cost. That's the argument we're here to make. Molly Delaney is here with me as well. She's our educational outreach director. Spent a lot of time working with teachers and in schools in our area. And I'm real pleased that you could be here.
I'm always pleased to be here with you, David. And we are, you know, in our financial planning process for the coming year here at the station. And I know because one of the things I'll be doing this afternoon is working on my budget. And a lot of people don't even realize all of the other services that we provide within the community. We're here, you know, on Focus today asking for your support because we know you're out there listening. We also want you to be aware that we're out in the community doing many things with schools, with childcare providers, with early childhood programs, reaching out in the community in a variety of ways. And it's great that we're here with, you know, on a program about financial planning. I was going to be a little more subtle than it's about money. We want some of yours.
I've given up on being subtle. I'm just not going to do it anymore.
But we are here to ask for your support. We're here to ask you as you're considering your budget in the coming year to determine what value you place on WILL, on the kind of program you're about to hear, and to include us in that budget. Make us a line item. Make us a protected line item. So again, make a call at 244-9455 or go to willpledge.org and let us know how much you value what you hear.
All right. Thank you very much. And we're also very happy to have back here on the program once again three guys who have been on the show, well, I don't know how many times, to dispense some financial advice and to be a resource. David Sano, John Masetich, and Kevin Waspy. And they are all three here this morning. We will be here for both hours. Yeah, we would just like to answer as many questions as possible. This is a great opportunity for you to sample some of their wisdom and experience. So if you have questions, and it doesn't matter whether you're just starting out and you have never invested and you're trying to figure out how to plan for the future, or you are in the middle somewhere, or you are thinking about retirement, wherever you are, whatever kind of question you have, call us and pose your question, and they'll do their best to help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Well, good morning, David, and of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure, and I echo all of your comments. WILL is an extraordinary place. It's an extraordinary station. I was just visiting with John just a minute ago. We were comparing it out to San Diego, and John even said that as large as the San Diego public radio programming is, this is superlative. This is actually better, and it's people like you, people like Molly, that make it the place it is. And I urge everyone to give and give generously to maintain the extraordinary programming and the personnel at WILL. Having said that, we have two additional people with us today, and I want to introduce each of them. They're going to speak briefly because we really want to entertain your questions. After all, that's what this is about. You've got three pretty sharp people who can answer a lot of financial questions. To my immediate left is John Masetich. John appears generally once or twice a year with us on Focus, and John is the president of Kensington Financial. He's really in the money management business, where he has clients literally all over the country. And John, for the last 10 years, has generously given of his time, come to the University of Illinois, and often taught for free to undergraduates, both in the College of Business and in the College of ACES. And we're very, very pleased to have John with us as well. And John's got some comments. And, of course, one of our old stalwarts like myself, Professor Kevin Waspy. We know that Kevin is a professor in the College of Business. He's in the Department of Finance. And he is a periodic guest on WILL as well. And, Kevin, I think you're going to start out and tell us a little bit about Money Smart Week.
Thank you, David. That is part of the reason why we're here with 2 hours of programming today. So real briefly, Money Smart Week kicked off this morning at the I Hotel, a little bit of a breakfast that I wasn't able to attend. But bottom line is, this is the fifth year that in Champaign County, local educators, local businesses have banded together to bring financial literacy into the community. Actually, this is a program that was started by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago in 2002, so they are no novices to financial literacy and financial education. But we'll talk during the program today about the various programs that are going on throughout the week, the topics that people can become more educated on, and hopefully learn good money management skills.
Thanks, Kevin. And John, I know it's Money Smart Week, but tell me, where's the smart money investing? Where are you investing money on behalf of your clients?
Well, David, thank you for that introduction. I guess that's presupposes that I actually run smart money. I think the jury is actually still out on that one.
Okay.
But here's what I'm doing for myself and my clients. But, you know, maybe first just a short history. You know, all the turmoil started at about the beginning of the year 2000. And between 2000 and 2002, we had the collapse of the dot-com companies, Silicon Valley. And over about a two-year period, we had about a 50% blowout in the stock market. And then flash forward about 4 or 5 years, we had real estate peaking. We had this extreme bubble that appeared in the real estate market between the mid-90s and about 2005. And since 2005, real estate in most major metropolitan areas is now down about 35-40%. Even in San Diego, which was going up about 15-20% a year, we're down about 35-40% from the peak. And it's actually much worse in other areas like Miami, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and so forth. So the question is now, in this very turbulent time, and in fact, we haven't seen this kind of turbulence and uncertainty since maybe the 1930s. A very fine writer, Andrew Lowe, a professor at MIT, called it that he said that we're oscillating between the madness of mobs and the wisdom of crowds. And right now, we seem to be in the wisdom phase. The crowd, the market right now, is up considerably since it bottomed in 2009. We're up, in fact, about 110% since the Dow bottomed at about 6,500, and now we're pushing 13,000. If you include dividends, the Dow is really about 15,000. So we've had well over a 100% increase. So now the question is, in light of all this continued uncertainty, what do we do with our money? Now, the money that I manage is mostly for older people. I'm 65, and that's probably my average client as well. My clients range from about 55 to about 85. Right now, we are more or less hunkering down with an asset allocation that's much more conservative than traditional asset allocations. We're down to about 35% in stocks and the other 65% in bonds and cash. And this is in contrast to a more traditional 60-40. So I've basically reversed the 60-40 to more or less 40-60 or 35-65. As a 65-year-old, I'm just not willing to risk losing a third to half of my money in retirement. After all, we only have one retirement. Assuming that reincarnation is not a fact of life, we only have one retirement. And so that's what we're doing, 35% in stocks. That includes some international stocks, although recently I drastically reduced my international exposure to European stocks. I believe there's real risk right now that the European currency block with the euro may not last. And there is renewed, it's not just Greece anymore, but it's Portugal and especially Spain. And on the fixed income side, more or less hunkering down with short-term bonds, short-term CDs, because I do think that interest rates are going to go up. We're at an all-time low right now. I think the likely direction of interest rates is up. If rates go up, bond prices go down. So I don't want intermediate-term bonds, and I certainly don't want long-term bonds. So I'm basically buying 1 to 2 year bonds, and I'm in CDs 6 months to maybe 18 months out. Based on the concept that rates are going to go up, and when these CDs and bonds mature, I will just roll them over at a higher rate. So kind of in a hunkering down position, and I don't see that's going to change anytime soon. Again, I just come back to the concept. We only have one retirement, and I'm just not willing to risk another 50% blowout that we have seen in two bear markets in stocks and one bear market in real estate.
You know, and that brings us to our couch potato portfolio very, very quickly, and I believe Harriet Williamson probably just posted that update. And thus far this year with that, remember it is a stock portfolio of indexes, it's pushing about 10% for the year, about 9.67 as I recall. And that compares, interestingly enough, with the S&P that is just north of 10%. So by being diversified in REITs, by being diversified in international emerging markets and various U.S. positions, the truth of the matter is that the good old-fashioned S&P 500 is actually outperformed to date through about the first, what, 3.5 to 4 months of the year, just slightly. And that's because, as John, you pointed out, you're a little concerned about international, and international positions have clearly pulled back in the last 30 days, especially even emerging markets. I don't know, Kevin, you have any feeling about international investing at this point?
I'd have to agree with John. The situation is probably unsettled and may remain unsettled throughout Europe, perhaps even Asia. The most recent growth out of China, for example, was a little bit shocking 2 weeks ago when announced. But I'll say it this way. It was shocking, but then we have to put it in perspective. The report of their economy growing at an 8.1% annual rate is something that developed economies would obviously envy for. We're seeing growth rates that are beneath 2% for the most part. But the shock of that report was one that took most of the optimists in the world of investing and made them rethink a little bit. Some of the things going on in Europe that John mentioned are compounded by the interlinked relationship that businesses have with China. So if growth is slowing in China, if things are unresolved with the Eurozone, just another potential reason to be cautious, a good thing.
Let me just get in here real quick because I do want to mention, because you just were talking about the couch potato portfolio, that in fact it has been updated. And if people want to look at this, they go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. And if you go to the focus section, it's really easy to find. And people occasionally, they say, well, specifically, where do these funds come from? And I know that, Dave, you're drawing on Vanguard.
That's right. Those funds are all Vanguard index funds. They're all listed. They're very easy to identify based upon the identification actually on the website. And, John, I think that, for example, if you were a 35% investor, maybe that type of portfolio with 35% of the money, with the exception of maybe pulling back on the international, would be a fairly reasonable position to be in.
Oh, I definitely agree. I would probably just make a minor little change to it. I would probably maybe, you know, reduce one or two of those funds that have more of a European exposure. Recently, when I said that I reduced my European stocks, I looked at all my international funds I had my clients in, and any fund that had, say, well over 50% in European stocks, I sold. But I didn't sell the ones that were much less than 50%. And I still have a small position in the emerging markets. I agree with Kevin that we have to be very concerned about the slowdown in China and in India. We also have to worry about the accounting in China. Are they really, is that 8.1% a real growth rate? Or is that, you know, jimmied up and, you know, I just don't know if we can really trust their accounting. So that would be my one qualification.
And I have clients calling me every day saying, what am I going to do with this money? Do I put it in a mattress? Do I leave it at the bank at 0.1%? Do I go out and try to buy yield by going out on the maturity curve 4, 5, 6 years? You're telling us, no, don't do that. Kevin, do you agree with that? Stay short on the maturity curve?
I would have to agree that the worst thing to do now is to stretch for yield, either by going out longer on maturities or lower in quality than a person is comfortable with. We've talked many times about strategies, and this is one of those classic times, I think, that strategy with a ladder of maturities just makes so much sense. You don't stretch for yield. You don't go out trying to lock in a rate of return. Not when interest rates are at all-time lows.
Let me just follow up on that one, too. I agree with Kevin on that. And recently I was about to buy a whole bunch of short-term bonds for clients, and I had been getting 2 to 3% in some really high-quality things like Berkshire Hathaway bonds, you know, Warren Buffett's company, and Wells Fargo Bank and stuff like that. And then what's happened in the last few months, there's been such a flight to safety, people just pouring money into short-term, high-quality bonds, that all of a sudden those yields went from 3% to about 1% or less. And but if you want to stretch for you, like what Kevin was just alluding to, you could buy Citigroup bonds or Bank of America bonds and get 3 to 5%. And I personally, I say, no way. Both companies are in serious trouble.
I think it's very difficult to do. And, of course, what a lot of people are doing is they're buying so-called dividend-paying stocks. That seems to be the most recent flavor on Wall Street is let's put you in a menu of stocks that have paid substantially high dividends, or let's purchase mutual funds that pay substantial dividends in the stocks that they are holding. And you've got to be a little bit careful because it's great to get 2, 3, 3.5% on your dollar, but sometimes that dollar dissipates. It deteriorates, and it may go to 90 or 91 cents. So always look, when you're looking at a mutual fund, the total return of the mutual fund. And this is especially important in bond funds because the current yield on some bond funds might be 2, 3, 4%. But the total return for the year, if the bonds go down in value, you may have a negative total return. Yeah. So that's an issue.
Let me take the opportunity here to introduce again our guests, and they are all people that you've heard on this program before in this segment, this regular investing program that we do every month. David Sino, John Masetich, Kevin Waspy, and I hope that, again, people who are listening, you will take the opportunity to call if you have questions, specific questions about your own situation. You know, take the opportunity to call in here and sample what these guys have to say. They have a lot of experience between the three of them, and they have sometimes different approaches, too, so you can contrast what one says as compared with the other. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. And also one reason that we are here is to just remind you that as a part of this Money Smart Week, there are many educational events going on. And if you go to the website of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, actually probably the easiest thing to do is just go into your browser and put in Money Smart Week, and you'll hit the Chicago site. You can go there and you look at the events. You can pick wherever you are. If you're in Champaign County, you pick Champaign County, and it will tell you about some of the things that are going on. There are a lot of great educational opportunities, free things that you can go to help you think about how you'd like to plan, do your financial planning. Now, there's something else we'd like you to do. include us in your financial plan. We're raising the money that will support the station next year. And the end of our fiscal year is June 30th. That's actually not that far away. And as we go through the year, we set benchmarks for ourselves. We, at certain points, we decide we got to have this much. So we're raising the money for next year. We've set some goals. We really want to try and meet them. And you can help us with that by calling 244-9455 or going online to willpledge.org. Here in studio with me is Molly Delaney.
And do you think it's fate that we're doing a pledge drive during Money Smart Week? I think
nothing
not.
On this program happens by accident.
It is the time of year when we're planning out the next fiscal year, and it's the time of year when, you know, I'm looking around the studio today with laptops and calculators, and I'm thinking this looks exactly like my office, my desk, because we are in that process of planning. We would like you to include us in your financial plan. We hope that you'll consider us a smart investment. We need to raise $250,000 in April to be meeting our goal for the year. We want you to be a part of that. We encourage you to be a part of that, but we need to hear from you at 244-9455 or make that pledge online at willpledge.org.
Yeah, we're trying to grow our base of support. That's why we periodically do this and come in front of the microphone, because it's the best way we have of talking to people who are not supporters. So if you listen for a while and you have not made a contribution, this would be a great time. And if it's time for you to renew, maybe if you could, possibly, you could increase your level of support a little bit. You know, that's for you to decide.
Right. We promise you a good return on your investment.
That's the pitch we try to make here. That truly is the case. Because what people are going to do, what they get back for their contribution is the programming.
Exactly.
You know, it's the assurance that when you turn the radio on, that show, whether it's Focus or All Things Considered or market information or whatever it is you tune to the station for, your contribution makes it certain that it's going to be there.
That's right.
That's
so
what it's all about.
We need to hear from you.
All right. Thank you very much, Molly. And we'll continue here. And we have a caller and would welcome others. Anyone, if you'd like to call in, ask a question, talk to our guests, David Sinnoh, Kevin Waspy, John Masetich. You just have to pick up the phone and dial the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You also may write to us by email if you want to do it like that. And that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay. To the phones, and we will talk with someone in Urbana. First caller here, line number one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I would like to ask about the bonds from some of the banks, Citigroup and a couple of others. I do own some of those bonds. And I was holding them thinking that the interest rate that I'm getting is much better than anywhere else available, around 6 or 7%. I've had them for a while. But David just said suggesting that you consider at the end of each year or at any given point, you also consider the total value of what you own, and so he chalks it up to a losing holding. Am I understanding what he said?
Well, what I said was that you have to look at individual bonds, and some of those bonds, while they're paying high interest rates, also can be subject to what is called credit risk, interest rate risk, and that can impact the actual value of the bond. So if you bought a bond at $100 and it pays 6% at the end of the year, that sounds like $106. But if you went to sell the bond, maybe the bond is selling in the marketplace for $90.
Yeah.
So
okay,
90 plus 6 would be 96. So that's the example of total return. And I'm going to let John talk to it because John is really our bond guy and spends a lot of time studying and analyzing bonds, especially Citi bonds, Bank of America bonds, some of the bonds it sounds like you have bought.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. What is the maturity of your bond, of the Citigroup bond?
Oh, it's down the road. I don't know. I couldn't tell you I couldn't tell you quickly, but I think it may be mid-20s.
Mid-2020s.
I think possibly,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, you definitely hold a risky position, and, you know. There's no question about it. If you had told me that the bond was going to mature in the next year or two, I would say, oh, you know, hold on to it. There's no danger in the short run here, I don't think, with Citigroup, but something that's, you know, another 10 years or 15 years down the road, I would be concerned about it. I would also look at your statement and maybe call your broker and just get a price on the bond.
Oh, no, I see the price. They're in Vanguard. I can see the price.
How much is it?
I can't see it right this second.
Okay.
It would take me a little while to pull it up.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of them are almost what I bought them at, you know, maybe 96, 98, but I think the Citigroup is probably I don't know, it's probably under that, yeah, maybe around.
Okay, well, if you're in a lost position on it, what, you know, tax-wise, what you might consider is selling something else in which you have a gain to match the loss in that bond. So if you sell something with a gain, you know, normally you would pay maybe a capital gains tax on that of 15%. But if you match that gain against the loss in the Citigroup bond, in effect, you get that gain in the other security you're selling for free. So that would be one thing to consider. But personally, I would be nervous about, you know, I have to be frank with you, I'd be nervous about holding a Citigroup bond that's still got another 10 or 15 years to go.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
Kevin, you feel similar on that one, or... Or more, it's maybe a more general question about just the length of bonds and credit risk with bonds.
Yeah, I would like to go a little bit to that. The name is one thing. The maturity is perhaps something else that we could talk about. Again, not to say that a person ought to take an action based on what they're hearing me say on a radio program, but to consider what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what they have as it might accomplish those goals. The old story of, you know, seeing a good rate of return from yield is one thing, as long as we're not seeing an opportunity to be frightful of price volatility. So interest rates up, bond prices down. We're at all-time lows in interest rates. I got to believe in the next 10, 12 years, they'll be higher. If the bond matures before or within that time and you're not concerned about price volatility, that's one question. Hold the bond. If you're not concerned about a credit risk, a default on the bond based on the name, hold the bond. That's a good thing. But just consider all of those things before you take any action.
Yeah, and I think you should talk to your financial advisor, namely about both of those issues. What type of risk, and can you model this out for me, if bonds and if interest rates, for example, move 1% higher, 2% higher, 3% higher, what does that do to the pricing of my bond? Especially if I'm concerned that maybe in the next few years I'm going to need to sell that bond because I need that capital, perhaps for retirement or for some other expense that comes up. So I think it's important to understand the downside risk of fixed income investments that you are holding. That's one question. And then secondly, with any bond, as John just pointed out, what type of credit risk do I have with that bond? And John, you feel pretty strongly about Citi, and I'm not too far behind you on that one. I think mm-hmm. that one does have some credit risk, and that also impacts bond pricing. So credit risk and volatility risk, discuss this with your financial advisor. Have them model this out for you so you understand ahead of time what are the risks. In the meantime, it's wonderful to be clipping coupons at 6 yes. or 7%. Mm-hmm. That is a strong incentive to hang on to the bond. So I hope we've helped you out a little bit.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. Right,
very good. Thank you. We'll go on to another caller. This is someone who is in Danville and our toll-free line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I understand that in certificates of deposit, either from a bank or from a credit union, one can assume that on payable on death to an individual with that individual's social security number. Is there anything inherent that you cannot indicate a charity, for example, as the payee if you die?
Yeah, the answer is yes. The answer is yes. You could certainly designate a charity. Well, that wouldn't be a problem. Now,
it certainly is with my bank and my credit union.
Ah, so they won't let you designate a charity direct.
No, they won't.
Ah, interesting.
And I
okay.
will say that, you know, obviously you can do this in a will, but it's pretty expensive to keep changing your, you know, adding things on your will. And I will say here that WILL has been included in my will for 20 or 30 years.
Well, that's wonderful. That's
yes.
that's wonderful.
But in case I wanted to give them another $5,000, you know, for a CD, well, then...
That's more difficult. Well,
yes,
I might have misspoken then because it was my opinion that you could, but evidently if a bank as well as a credit union, they would know the rules better than I would, and it may very well be that a POD is only for individuals. You also raise a question, of course, of insurance on the certificates of deposit. If you have a POD and one is to John Doe with a Social Security number and another one is to Mary Doe with a Social Security number, a different Social Security number, then you're insured on both of those certificates of deposit up to $250,000 each. One of the things that you might consider doing, and again, this is going to a lawyer and spending some money. There's no way around it if you want to leave money to charity, and that is to either look at your will again and perhaps as opposed to making a specific devise of X number of dollars to
no, I do it. My last will is a percentage.
Exactly. I was just going there. You would give a percentage as
right,
opposed to a specific
and I
amount.
I do include about 6 or 7 charities with 5 or 10%. But I would like to, you know, without having the expense of redrawing a will, which is, well, considerable, if someone can answer this for CD, I mean, obviously charities have their own taxpayer identification number.
Well, they do.
So I don't know why that should not suffice.
Well, one other possibility.
I've just done a little searching here, and it is possible under state law that there may be a prohibition against naming a not-for-profit or a charity under a paid on death beneficiary basis. So I would.
You mean Illinois state law prohibits that?
No, I do not know that. I only know that it's possible that certain states might prohibit that. So whether or not Illinois does, that might be the reason the credit union, the bank, wherever you're dealing with, might be telling you that.
I also have another suggestion. You might call a brokerage firm. Do you have a brokerage account?
Yes.
Okay. Ask them if they would. Sometimes they are. I have found that they are far more flexible than banks. I used to work for a bank.
You mean get a CD through a brokerage account?
Yes, absolutely. I deal with Charles Schwab. They're the world's largest discount broker, and I have found they are much more flexible on different types of accounts than most banks.
Huh. Okay, well, thank you very much.
And something, just one other idea, it might be a little bit more difficult, but you could, I believe, and again, I'm just surmising this would have to be checked with your bank or your credit union, is you could put a certificate of deposit in joint ownership. And that is that joint tenancy with the right of survivorship, and at your death, that certificate of deposit balance would automatically, by operation of law, escape your estate, escape probate, and it's paid directly to the named payee. In the meantime, you could grab the interest and you could report it under your Social Security number, even though you have it in joint tenancy with the right of survivorship. That is done all of the time with all kinds of investments. So you might check that out as a possibility as well. Of course, then you would have to delineate a specific CD to a specific charity, but that might solve the problem as well.
We're taking questions this morning on personal finance. We do this every month on the show. It's always on a Friday. We have three guests here, John Masetich, Dave Sinno, Kevin Wasby. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign. Along with their dinner menu, tapas is served every evening until 2 a.m. Brunch is also served on Saturday and Sunday from 10:30 to 2:30. Information on menus and wine and beer lists is at RadioMariaRestaurant.com.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. We're here weekday mornings. We have 10 different topics for you every week. This morning, both hours of the show devoted to discussion of financial issues, and this is an opportunity for you to call in and get some advice, talk with one of or all of these guys here, and between the three of them, they have a lot of experience in financial planning. And this is a show that we have been doing for a long time. And in fact, at the very beginning of Focus, the idea was that all of the programs essentially would be how-tos like this. And after thinking about that for a while, we thought, well, that was kind of limited that just to do that. Let's do whatever we think we can work. But we decided that programs like this would be a part of the schedule. And I don't know that there are very many programs that actually try to do both of those sorts of things. So we do politics and we do history and we do science, but we also do these shows that we hope will help people with these nuts and bolts issues of everyday life. And people have told us, you know, over the years that they've learned things, that they've benefited, and we are happy. But we also want you to understand that more than 40% of the money that it takes to run the station comes from folks like you. And we rely on you to keep the station strong. If you're a supporter, thank you very much. But if you're not, now is the time. Now is the time to call or to go online. Molly Delaney is here with me to help make the pitch.
That's right. David was just saying, you know, 40% of our budget comes from listener and viewer support. That's a lot. That's really a strong statement about what people feel about the station and how much people value these, you know, quote unquote, how-to programs, because really they are still, in their essence, how-to programs. The show today, obviously, you're saying, you know, really is helping with people with their everyday situations and everyday lives. We try to inspire, we try to educate, and we have a lot of support already, but we need more. We need you. So if you've been a listener, you're still a participant in our community here at Focus, but we're asking you today to actually take that next step, to make a financial step toward contributing to this program and contributing to the station. And there was a great quote that these guys brought in early in the program where they said, we're looking now, kind of talking about the economy, and we're looking from the madness of mobs to the wisdom of crowds. And, you know, we have thousands of supporters. We want you to be part of that wise crowd. Join us today at 244-9455 or go to willpledge.org and let us know how much you value this show.
All right. Thank you very much. We're taking questions this morning. We have some people who are online. I have some emails we'll get to. We'll be here for both hours of the show. So if we do not get to your question in the first hour, we will do our best to get it in the second hour, particularly for the folks who are calling in here and who are sending their questions along by the email. Let me just again very quickly introduce the guests. Kevin Waspy, he's a lecturer in finance here at the U of I in the College of Business. Dave Sino, clinical professor of finance in the College of Business. And John Masetich, he's an adjunct lecturer. He also has his own business, his own money management firm, Kensington Financial. And they've all been guests on this program before. To the phones now, and we have somebody who's been patient, and we'll get to them. This is Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Hello. I have a question for investing, maybe a tool that you might use. I've used a lot of tools in the past and have lost money all the time, so thought I might try this. That I understand the market almost makes all of the money in the 6 months between November and April, and makes very little money from May through October. And I have some money in a qualified account, and that maybe take some of that money and take it in and out of, say, the Vanguard Total Market, that you could possibly do better by having it in and out, and you wouldn't have the tax consequences or low fees. Is there any validity to doing that?
Well, what you're really talking about is market timing. And to be very, very frank, I have never met a successful market timer. If you look at the Forbes 500 wealthiest Americans, none of those are market timers. They're entrepreneurs, they're great investors, but it's very, very difficult in short periods of time, regardless of historical information that appears in the past, to outthink the market. With respect to mutual funds, it's getting even more difficult because now many mutual funds, including Vanguard in some of their funds, are saying that if you move in and out within 90 days of certain funds, there is a penalty. And believe me, those penalties often offset any perceived gains that you may make. So I am not a market timer. I think it's important that you have money in the market because there are periods of time where the market makes rapid moves. That historically has been proven, and it's important that you have some exposure to the market all of the time so that you can be the beneficiary of those moves. But as far as just being in and out, I think that's left to a lot of professionals, and they're not so good at it either because I've never met one who is retired. I've never met one who has a substantial net worth, and certainly they aren't any of the Forbes folks that I read about. So I don't know how you fellas feel about it.
Yeah, David, I generally agree. I think one of the phenomena that the caller is alluding to is the phrase, sell in May and go away, because it's been shown that most of the gains in bull market years actually occur by, I don't know, May 15th or so. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the year is rather lackluster. So this year we've had, what, a 10% increase?
10% to date.
And so, you know, it could be an argument to, you know, sell pretty soon and go away until the end of the year, maybe January of next year. But I agree with David about the, you know, the timing aspect, the timing implication to your question. But I'll come back to the asset allocation that you might have. I could see your strategy maybe if you're rebalancing, if this is the time you've appointed for yourself to rebalance. And let's say you want to be in a 60, I'm just going to make this up, a 60-40 position, stocks and bonds, and maybe you're now at 70-30, but you really want to be at 60-40. So there would be an argument, along with the sell in May and go away, you know, theory, to take some money off the table now, bring your 70-30 down to 60-40, and it's been shown in academic studies that rebalancing is a powerful and a very effective thing to do. Because when you're selling something that's gone up in value and you're buying something that's gone down in value, you're selling your winners, buying a loser, but it just tends to work out. So I would look at your asset allocation before you would make that switch. But I agree with David that you don't want to make such a drastic switch. If you're making a drastic allocation, it's really just disguised market timing. Okay, but if you're going 70-30 down to 60-40, or if you're going 50-50 down to 40-60, that would be more what I would call a tactical asset allocation move rather than a market timing move.
I agree. I'm going to start with a real simple definition or distinction. I would like to have anyone thinking about timing literally ask this question first. Are we investing or are we trading? If the answer is investing, then timing is something that I think is counterproductive. If we're talking about trading, then it may be a different matter. So if a person is looking at qualified money that they're literally investing for the long haul, I would say market timing probably fits John Masetich's suggestion quite well. In other words, I'm not a market timer. I am going to be a rebalancer just because rebalancing is a very powerful thing to do over an investing long time frame. So coordinating that with, market movements is not a timing movement, but really a rebalancing strategy. But if I'm trading, sure, I might look at patterns, and here's the caution I'll have. Our minds love to find patterns even where none exist.
Exactly. And, you know, there have been all kinds of academic studies that have been done that says, look, if I earn a dollar from investments, where does that dollar really come from? About 90% of that dollar is based upon how you allocated that dollar. In other words, the relationship between stocks and bonds and the relationship within those asset classes, about 90%. About 7% is what you chose, especially when it comes to stocks. Did I choose Apple or did I choose IBM or did I choose AT&T and did I sell something? That's about 7%. And when it comes to market timing, almost all of these academic studies say it's very, very tiny, and some of them suggest it's even negative. Mm-hmm. So maybe 2 or 3% of the overall return that you earn on a dollar is getting in and out at the appropriate times. Very tough to do.
Yeah, I'll add to that let's say it's 90% asset allocation, it's 4 or 5%, what I would call security selection, and maybe just 2 or 3% market timing. That famous study was a gentleman by the name of Gary Brinson. Everybody references the Brinson study today. It's been updated 2 or 3 times. And in that study, he actually looked at pension fund managers, supposedly really sophisticated people, and their market timing effect was actually negative. You know, all the timing moves they made were generally bad.
I need to jump in here. I hope I think you guys have done a pretty good job with the question. We're getting a little short on time for this hour. I have one more caller I'd like to try to include, and as I said a little earlier, our guys here will be with us for the second hour, so we'll have plenty of time to go further. And I do have some email questions I want to get, but let's see if we can get in here someone from Urbana, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question that might apply to quite a few people in the community. I'm looking at people retired from the University of Illinois, let's say in their 60s, and they have a pretty good pension coming in and can live off of that. They don't have to touch their IRA or anything else that they may have saved. And so it would make sort of sense, and that's, I think, to have more of that savings in stocks because it's not actually needed except if two things happen. The state really goes bankrupt and can't pay the pensions anymore, and the stock market crashes too. So I wanted to get a perspective on that, if it didn't make more sense to be more heavily in stocks in that situation.
I would totally agree with that, because I'm sitting next to three gentlemen, Kevin, David, and David, that are the lucky beneficiaries of a defined benefit plan from the state of Illinois. Now, I, as a money manager in San Diego, I don't have such a thing. I've been self-employed for 27 years, and I have to create my own monthly annuity. So that's why what I said earlier, that you know, I'm only about 30-35% in stocks, because I don't have that nice foundation or that cushion of a relatively safe defined benefit plan. But if you're a retired teacher, and I've got a couple of teacher friends from suburbs in Chicago, they have over $100,000 of defined benefit income coming in every year. they're my age, they could well afford to be 50, 60, even 70% in stocks.
Yeah, I'm agreeing. When I do a net worth analysis for clients, I explain to them, look, if you have a defined benefit plan, if you're fortunate enough to have be a CSRS recipient or any of these other programs, then you really need to treat that for the most part as fixed income in your portfolio. And when you look at the present value of that future payout, the odds are that most of your assets are in fixed income and not in stocks. You're probably overbalanced in fixed income. So again, in your TIAAs, in your CREFs, in your 403Bs, in your Roth IRAs, you can afford to up that asset allocation more into stocks and less into fixed income, so long as you feel comfortable with the financial integrity of your annuitized payments.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and as long as the state can continue to pay the pensions, that's the...
yeah, Chris, cross our fingers on that
right.
one.
Stay tuned.
Thank you very much for the call. This is something actually going way back to the beginning. I was thinking about this business of asset allocation, and I was listening to John, and you're talking about being very conservative about how much you're in stocks. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, well, you know, it wasn't really all that long ago. Maybe it was when the market was doing better, that I think people were saying, even for people say over 50, they were being pretty aggressive about how much they thought it was okay to be in stocks. And I just was more interested in, you know, do you have how many different variables? Is there some kind of really easy kind of formula that you can use in your head to think about, okay, so how much really is it okay for me to be in stocks?
No, I don't think there's really any formula. I think every situation is unique. And the main thing is whether you have, you know, that very secure pension payment that you're going to get. That's a game changer. You know, if you have that, you can afford to be more aggressive. If your house is paid off, there's another factor. If you have a pretty stable job situation, there are some people who do have a nice stable job situation. I don't know too many, but I suppose there are. You're right, David. There are a number of factors. But I think the main thing is whether you have a defined benefit payment plus maybe a generous Social Security payment. Social Security is nothing to sneeze at. Work a long time, and I think the maximum payment can be as much as $2,800 a month. So that, along with the defined benefit payment, that would certainly imply a greater willingness to take risk. Mm. Not just stocks, but other stuff, real estate, commodities, whatnot.
We're coming down to the point here we're going to have to pause. I have a number of questions here that have come in through email, and here's one. I don't know if we can do this in just a couple of minutes. Someone would like to have you talk about TIPS. This is Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, is that right? And wants to know whether TIPS would be suitable place for money taken out of 401 as a required minimum distribution.
I would suppose that... if the money is coming out of a retirement plan as a minimum age attainment distribution, that a Treasury and inflation-protected security is probably okay. But I guess I would wonder what the age of the person was. We know they're over 70 and one half. That's the age at which minimum distribution requirements occur. Mm-hmm. So, again, I'd have to say, what's the objective? And quite frankly, how long do they have as a life expectancy to have the worry about inflation that they're trying to protect?
Okay, very good. Well, we're going to take a little bit of a break here. And our three guests, John, Dave, and Kevin, will be with us for the second hour of the show. This program, this money management show, is something that has been a regular part of our schedule for a long time, really going back to the beginnings of Focus. And that's now more than 30 years ago. And we put it here in the schedule because we knew that listeners would always have questions. And one of the things that we hope this program will do is help with basic stuff, answer basic questions. And, you know, sometimes that's, where do I put my money? And sometimes that's, how do I fix my car? And sometimes that's, doctor, it hurts when I do this. I mean, it's all that kind of stuff. In addition to the other programs we do, we make this program as useful as we can. And we hope that it's entertaining to listen to, and it's instructive. And we're here 40 hours worth every month without any interruption, except occasionally when we have to remind folks just how important their support is. Molly Delaney is here to help me do that. We're here, well, I guess about midway through our fundraising effort here for this for the month of April. And what do we want people to do?
Well, we want them to make a contribution. We want them to show us how much they value this program, how entertaining and educational they find it. So we're asking them to step up and to go to the phone, make that pledge of support at 244-9455, or to go to willpledge.org and let us know what they think. You know, there's a place where you can make comments that you can let us know exactly what you think of the programming. We do want to hear from you, and we want to hear from you as a listener. We want to hear from you as a financial contributor to the station. I do have good news.
Yes.
Heather Miller just gave me a little post-it note that talks about the response that we've gotten so far. We have mentioned that we're on our way to a $250,000 goal for the month of April. That seems daunting, but yesterday we had 97 pledges, and so far today we've had 38. So that's very encouraging. That doesn't mean that we're at 250,000 yet. It just means we're on our way. So again, we need to hear from you. So get to that phone, get to your computer. Let us know how you feel about the station and about Focus.
Yeah, we want to keep the place strong. And I've mentioned that Focus has been on the air here now 30 years. We celebrated that anniversary last year. And WILL has been on the air for 90 years.
It's a long time.
It's a long time. And so you can tell we've made a commitment here. We're not going to go away. But to continue to do the work and to keep the place strong, we need to hear from as many listeners as we possibly can. That's why we do things like this periodically throughout the year.
That's right.
All right. Well, the number again, 244-9455. You can go to willpledge.org. We will continue. We'll have some more Focus in just a little bit. However, we got to tell you about some of the people who support the station, and then we'll have a market update for you.